thanks for sticking to the timetable. So we're in the run to lunch, and in this hour and a half, we're going to look at flood mitigation strategies and options, both from the engineering perspective and also from the government perspective, with our three speakers, and we'll keep question time till the end. So each speaker will talk for about 20 minutes, which would take an hour, and then we have half an hour for questions. So as it can be facilitated more easily, perhaps your SMS questions, you might compile those as we go, rather than wait till the end, because it'll be, by that stage, 40 minutes or so after the first speaker. So let's do it as we go. So the engineering perspective from Mark Babister, from WM Water and Chair of the National Committee on Water Engineering, and Norm Himsley, a dams consultant, and the government perspective from Mike Rothery, who's First Assistant Secretary, National Security Resilience Policy Division at the Attorney General's Department. Let me introduce Mark first of all. Mark has over 20 years of experience in water engineering studies. He's the current Chair of Engineers Australia's National Committee on Water Engineering, and a member of the steering committee, or the steering and technical committees, that are overseeing the updating of Australian rainfall and runoff. He's carried out numerous flood studies and floodplain management studies. So please welcome Mark Babister.
Thank you. I'm an engineer, as you've just been told, but I don't actually think most of the solutions to flooding are engineering solutions. So I don't want to disappoint people. Whenever there's flooding, people jump to engineering solutions. I'm going to talk about getting it right the first time, floodplain mapping, and a few other things. I think it's a strong message I wish to push. The solutions are not always dams and levees. They're what you do when you've got nothing left. So, okay, before I get started, I wouldn't want to be in the insurance business in Australia either. Flooding. When white settlement occurred in Australia, we turned up from the UK and Europe. We had this idea that a river came up. When you had a bit of rain, it came up a foot or two. In Australia, it comes up 10 metres, 20 metres, right? And so if you read the early accounts, people are progressively moving further and further up the hill as they sort of worked it out the hard way. And unfortunately, 200 plus years later, we're still doing that. So you're in a tricky business, and we've got climate change to deal with as well. So, yeah, I wouldn't want to be in the insurance business, but I spend my life talking to flood-prone communities, coming up with solutions, trying to help them work through their problems, and most of those solutions are not hard engineering. But I am building a levee now, and I'm doing a house-raising program at Kempsey as well, but generally not hard engineering. Now, a couple of embarrassing things, I guess, from the engineering perspective. The National Guidelines on Calculating Flood Risk, we updated them in 1987 last time. We've done one chapter since, but basically they're 25 plus years old. And for those people who are younger than me, not everybody had a computer on their desk, only the nerds did in those days. And mobile phones, these things were on science fiction TV shows, okay? So it's a long time in the past. So the way we're calculating flood risk is a little bit out of date. We're at the process of updating it at the moment, but we don't have funding to finish it. So if you want to do something about flooding, we need about $5 million to finish that. Otherwise, that process will come to a halt. That's even with a volunteer effort that's probably around $5 million of industry in-kind time so far. Okay, flood risk. What's new? What are we dealing with? Technology's changed in 25 years. Blockage is a big thing. We're pretty quick on the uptake being engineers. Climate change, nothing new. We knew about climate change in 1987. And we're starting to understand finally some of the things like the interaction of ocean and the rainfall. There's a lot of things we've been making some pretty coarse assumptions on. So technology is changing. Just getting on with blockage, it's a major cause of urban flooding. And up until 10 plus years ago, it was ignored. Wollongong in 1998 was the first wake-up call, and they introduced a policy. But not being real quick on the update, 9 years later, We have the same thing occur in Newcastle. A large amount of the flooding is caused by blockage. We keep putting stuff in our floodplains, and what we've done here too is make our cars lighter and more fuel efficient. They float better, they block things up. Like, unintended consequences. Yeah, that's one of the unintended consequences of cars. If you had a car 30 years ago, when water flooded it, it just sunk. They had holes and the doors didn't shut well, they filled up with water. These days, they do that. So that's a big issue, blockage. Climate change. 1987, we said at Engineers Australia, we're a bit worried about climate change. You don't have to read the detail, but we don't know what to do with it. So when people say that climate change is new, it's not new. That was quite a while ago. And we've been concerned. And what we decided in 1987 was, well, nobody can tell us what's going to happen other than it's probably going to be bad. So we're largely going to ignore it and keep... We updated one chapter of our 14-chapter guideline on working out flood risk in 1999. And what did we do then? We said, well, we still don't know what to do with climate change. And until there's sort of some scientific advice on how to deal with it, we're going to monitor things. So that was 1999. Now... Well, we're finally getting somewhere with climate change. I'm chairing a group with the Bureau of Meteorology, CSIRO, the Department of Climate Change and Energy Efficiency, Engineers Australia and a few others, trying to work out a strategy. Rainfall extremes is probably the hardest part of climate science. It's pretty hard generally because you have a very, very small sample in one location. Now, you only get a couple of large events in our whole European settlement in a location. But we do know some other things. We do know if you raise the temperature of the atmosphere, you can carry more moisture in the atmosphere and potentially have greater rainfall. You can learn about that in primary school or high school. But taking it the next step to how things change is pretty complex. And antecedent conditions... I don't want to sort of bore you with technical talk, but one big thing in flooding you've probably heard about is the different cycles, whether it's interdecadal Pacific Oscillation or ENSO and all this sort of stuff. Those cycles that you see change how much moisture is on the ground before flood events occur. And that's climate change, even if it doesn't change the rainfalls that produce a flood, will change those conditions you get before a flood, and that makes a big difference to how much flooding you get and how high it is. So that's the other way climate change is going to affect things. And that's something that's a little bit easier to work out. So climate change is real, in case anybody's in doubt. We've been known about it for a long time, and it's going to change flooding in Australia. And if rainfall intensities go up by 5 or 10%, which is what we think... You know, that will turn a 100-year flood into a 10 or a 20-year flood. So it's going to have some significant effects. How are we working it out? Like, I don't want to bore you with climate science. It's pretty tough stuff. I find it hard. But we use techniques called, well, climate scientists do, called statistical and dynamic downscaling techniques based on global circulation models. Well, those two techniques give different answers. It's a bit of a problem. And that's pretty much where we are. They're the only two techniques of any scientific merit. Different people use the different techniques to get different answers, but the two techniques give different answers. And we're scratching our head on what to do. Have we seen a climate change signal? Well, not in extreme rainfalls. We've analysed every rainfall record in the country, and we can't detect one. Now, we don't expect to. That's in terms of short durations like rainfall over 3 days or 1 hour that will create a flood. So we can't detect it. The US, they've tried it in the Ohio Valley and the Colorado states, they can't detect it as well. But it's also not expected because the signal coming from the flood signal coming out of our climate record is really weak compared to all the noise from the variability in our climate record. And that's the big issue in Australia. We get massive variability in our rainfall. That's why We're slowly learning and moving up the hill, and 200 years later we haven't worked it out. It's a lot easier in the rest of the world. So, flood mapping. I guess this is what you want me to talk about. Look, it's a really interesting task. I do a lot of it. Councils want it. Up until recently, they weren't allowed to have it under in New South Wales. The state government actively discouraged the production of flood maps. Planning agencies want it. The State Emergency Service really like flood mapping. It helps them deal with problems. Obviously, the insurance industry wants it. Home purchasers want it. And I can tell you, people selling homes don't want it, right? They don't want it at all. When we put labels on telegraph poles saying how high the 1955 flood got or whatever else, you can tell when somebody's going to sell a house because the ladder goes up the telegraph pole, the sign comes down or goes up or disappears. People selling homes think they've got some right to con the next owner like they were conned. So it's a really big issue, and politically it's been very controversial. For those people who are younger than me, again, it nearly changed the state government in this state. Neville Rand changed the rules at the very last minute with the state election, and it probably got him over the line. He effectively declared all flood maps didn't exist. They physically existed, but in a legal sense they didn't, because people couldn't get home loans for houses. So while everybody's calling for flood maps, there is going to be some political consequences. A couple of years ago, we had some stuff in Western Sydney where residents didn't like being told they were at risk of flooding. Admittedly, it was about the risk between a 100-year event and a probable maximum event. They managed to get the minister on the radio to say, whose manual on managing flooding is this? You know, we're not going to let this happen. It was his manual. It was his department. It is very, very controversial. So flood maps will come with a lot of political angst. And if you tie flood mapping, if it gets used in people can buy and sell houses, that's when it goes really bad. If home people lending money say you must have flood insurance, and if it's going to cost you 10 grand a year, and that's what it does for some flood-prone houses at the moment, there'll be political consequences. So I can't emphasise that. Accuracy of flood maps. This is another problem, and we're going to learn about this real quick if we go down this path. For land use planning, realistically, taking the technology to the best you can do, you're looking at plus or minus 300 mils on, say, a 100-year flood level. That's what you need if you're going to get it right. For a council, they want the same, but a lot of councils like to be conservative. Wollongong Council is a good example, but there's plenty around the state and plenty around the country. It assumes every culvert will block and won't block. Both are 100% likely. So I don't know what that means, but I do know what the outcome is. The outcome is if you've got lots of culverts, the probability of flooding that they put on their maps is much rarer than what they say. So in Wollongong, if you pull out a 100-year flood line, it's probably somewhere between 100 and 400 years. So their maps don't denote proper flood risk because they like to be conservative. And other councils do it in different ways. And if the insurance industry starts using these flood maps for risk rating, there's going to be a conflict between the punters being charged more because their council's conservative. So there's going to be some problems. I don't know what accuracy you want for insurance. I'm hoping somebody will tell me. So, and the public, when you deal with the public with a flood map, they're pretty good about it. They just want it perfect. And if it shows they're at flood risk, then they want it changed. So, and they've been there for 10 years or they've been there for 20 years and it's never flooded, so there's no flood risk. So there's a big issue with accuracy and expectations and bias. I guess that's what I'm talking about. Land use planning, yeah. You don't really want any bias. Councils, they like to be conservative, so they're introducing bias into these maps. And they're all doing it differently. They're all tailoring it to their local circumstances. I guess from an insurance viewpoint, you probably want everybody in the whole country with no bias so you can work it out. So that's an issue. If you're going to do flood maps for the country, you need LIDAR. What does that mean? It means laser infrared data. Anyway, they fly a plane over and you collect the ground terrain with an infrared radar signal. It's the only way to get the ground contours cost-effectively and accurately enough for flood mapping. Any other technique that doesn't use that is either extremely expensive or not accurate enough. Now, the government has finally got together a national program to coordinate this information, because the companies that supply this information, they're pretty smart. They collect it once, sell it about 10 times. It's a very good business model. So that's becoming available. Ooh, I've got to go back. Okay, mapping. If you're going to do flood mapping, you're going to have to use, because of our high stream flow variability and stuff, you have to use what's called a hydrodynamic model or a hydraulic model if you're going to use it for land use planning or a council. There are simple GIS techniques. They don't work well in Australia. They work well overseas where the flood risk is pretty boring. And there's also some rapid evaluation techniques. They're not going to be suitable either. Just a couple of pictures. We do a lot of flood mapping. We do a lot of 3D. We do a lot of animations. This is a major urban renewal area in sort of not far from here. It's got a bit of a problem. If you look on the maps from 1850, it was a dam and a swamp. I'll let you work that out. There's a train station there too, where a new train station, which you can fill the whole train line up with water in a pretty small flood. Other flood maps, we've come a long way with the sort of how we can communicate these things. This is the Pacific Highway at Kempsey. It's a big flood area. That's what happens up there in a 100-year flood. This is Wagga, a place where I've spent a lot of time as well. They've decided to put a hole in their levee to facilitate vehicular access, and if they don't fill it in time, there's a little yellow spot there. That's what happens there. So it's a bit of an issue. Levees are not a perfect solution. You have to maintain them. This council's not the best at maintaining it because it's very expensive. And then you'll have to make sure any gaps in it are plugged up. And if it's like Ningen, the gap was 400 metres and it wasn't going to happen. This is Kurnell. Kurnell is surrounded by Botany Bay on three sides, and the average ground level is about 3 or 4 metres, and the whole place floods. Unfortunately, we put the road system on at 45 degrees to the dune system, so water ponds everywhere. Places like this, with climate change, with elevated ocean levels, the whole town will become unviable. Swansea is the same. There's plenty of examples in New South Wales. I just need to mention this. In terms of flood mapping, 2D simulation, that's a lot of bad things, I guess, or warnings, but we do have national guidelines coming out on how this is to be done. That's one of the big positive steps we've made in information technology in Australia. I won't bore you with the engineering, but people will be doing their modelling on a nationally consistent basis and they'll be using things correctly. So we've made a lot of progress there, and that'll be in the next version of Australian rainfall and runoff. What should we be doing about flooding? Look, there's some really simple things that we could do. They're not going to affect flooding from big rivers, but or most of them, but for overland flow, I reckon, and so do most of my colleagues, if you made every house all the way around it 300 mils above the ground level, the front door, the back door, you could probably eliminate 80 to 90% of overland flooding. It would cost effectively nothing extra for every new house. Yet, time and time again, I'm called to look at flood problems where somebody's paved and filled their backyard and created a beautiful path, drain, watercourse into their house for floodwaters. So if we're talking about national guidelines, the Building Code of Australia, if I was in the insurance industry, I'd be pushing that one. Communities need to be made aware of their flood risk. And they need to be told that floods bigger than the planning flood will occur, do occur. There is no line where you're safe unless you're at the very top of the hill. There is just different degrees of risk, and they need to plan for these things. I'd certainly like $5 million to finish off Australian rainfall and runoff. That's, I guess, my plug. But so we could update our national guidelines from the pre-computer era, and or personal computer era. And I'd like to see all information public, every piece of information. It's not going to be pleasant at times, but I really think if we want to address flooding in this country, we have to be completely open. And with the internet, you know, that's something that can be done really easily. Some councils are good at it, some are atrocious. And another thing we really need, and this is a hard thing, and I don't expect anybody to understand it to a great degree of difficulty, we're not real good at measuring high flows in our rivers. It's really hard. OH&S has made it very complex, because people have died doing it. But if we want to understand flooding, we need to measure the flows in our river. And that usually means people going out in boats or off bridges with special electronic equipment measuring the flow. Unless we can measure something, we can't really understand it properly. So they're the simple things. None of them cost that much money. Some harder things. Look, you do need quality flood studies if you're going to actually work out flood risk. There's no cheap and easy solution to this. Now, I do quite well out of that because that's what I do for a living. But if you want to know about flood risk, you've got to do it. National mapping. I was asked recently by the federal government what's it going to cost to do the whole of Australia, and I was given half an hour, so I had a pretty big envelope to do it on the back of. And it's going to cost around $300 million was our back of the envelope calc to do the whole place, and about a third of that had been Queensland, because there's very little work done there. And that's to get mapping suitable for land use planning. A big thing, and I thought about putting this in the simple category, and then I ummed and ahed and put it back, stop blocking urban flow paths, right? This happens all the time. In an urban area, often there's not a, originally wasn't a flood problem, it's just people have done things to block a flow path, to make their yard better or to make a park better or whatever else, or often for security now as well. When we have a large event, water needs to get from wherever it is to the ocean, and you need to make sure these residual flow paths through urban areas are not blocked, and it just keeps happening again and again and again. And it's probably about a third of major urban flooding is caused or exacerbated by flow paths being blocked. Councils struggle with it. They go to court, the Land and Environment Court in this state all the time, but it's a big issue. Correct land use planning. One thing about flooding is it costs very little to get it right in the first place, and it's extremely expensive, and it comes out of the public purse generally to fix it up afterwards. And it's not necessary to get it, you know, we can get it right, certainly with all new development. There's enormous pressure on land development. A lot of it's in flood-prone areas, but we still keep making mistakes. Some other things that I think the government, largely state government, should be looking at, and if there's any planners here, I'm going to apologise in advance. They hate when I say this. Some land swapping and also moving the entitlement for development is a very effective way to get some stuff done. I'll just go quickly. Look, this is Kempsey. We have some areas here. These are all flood prone. They've been on a buyback scheme since about the last 20 years. They're rented out. They're owned by investors. They're rented out, these houses. They do no maintenance, the owners. People live in there. It's a slum. And they've got a guaranteed buyback from the state government when they want to give up their house when it's completely worn out. We could remove those houses, the ones in purple, and let people develop land in the orange by moving the right to develop things. We could solve the problem at Kempsey at no cost to the public purse, but I'm told planning-wise it's illegal. I noticed some things like that are happening in Queensland. One simple way is to move the entitlement to development at no cost. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. That's very enlightening and gives a source of questions. So keep your SMS questions coming.